Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Emily Post-Structuralism, and it is about, well, it's about a Tumblr account, isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
That's all. And our guest for this episode is the I guess, creative force behind said, the visionary, mm-hmm. the joie de vivre, whatever, Mr. Luke Niebler, who is also one of my Pinko Kami adjunct friends, who has decided to waste his life with pithy thoughts and adjunct wage slavery. So yeah, so say something for yourself there, Mr. Niebler.
Well, thank you very much, Matt, for having me on the show. Yep, I am a itinerant academic going between schools, teaching, and I make a weird advice Tumblr called Emily Post-Structuralism, where I answer questions that no one asked me.
Okay, so that's the first thing. So there's not a, like, submit...
There is. People can submit their questions, but I've only gotten two legitimate questions from close friends of mine, and the rest I take from Yahoo Answers, actually.
Oh!
Yeah. I spend hours combing through Yahoo Answers trying to find likely questions to answer.
Oh, that's fascinating. I was always wondering, like, what about, if you thought about, like, the Google... Like, what if that and that weird, like, thing, like, it's always, like, maybe it's not necessarily, sometimes it's the first result, mm-hmm. and sometimes it's the fourth or fifth, you go, wow, what is going on in people's lives? Kind of, like, fill in the blank thing that it does.
Oh, yeah, and, I mean, one thing that's great about Yahoo Answers is that, I don't know, it just collects the strangest, weirdest parts of the internet, because it's people who don't know how necessarily to use Google or choose not to. And they have a question, a burning question, and their first recourse is to go to Yahoo Answers and just ask random, you know, trolls and do-gooders and grandpas how they can live their lives.
Which, I mean, okay, so already, wow. So the first thing I'm thinking about now is that you're taking, like, sort of, like, I don't say lowbrow internet, but, like, folks who are trying to merge onto the information superhighway, which in and of itself is a grandpa term at this point, and I've just dated myself. I am old, and my flesh is slowly rotting off my bones already just by saying that word, but folks who are trying to merge onto that in, like, a VW bus from the 60s or something, you know, that they just can't, and you're taking to this, like, more sophisticated place.
Yeah, it's a really strange place, because the other major group that I've noticed, it's, like, grandpas, trolls, and, like, 14-year-olds. There's lots of super young people who are using it, and, like, there's this strange social aspect to it well. Like, these are people who would love Reddit or, you know, Kinja with Gawker or some other mm-hmm. social interactive means of communication, but they just haven't gotten there, and they somehow wind up on Yahoo Answers with these strange questions, like, what did you have for dinner tonight? Or, am I pregnant? questions that, like, no one could conceivably answer. It's very weird.
That's, wow. And that's, the internet is just so wonderful and horrible at the same time. I'm still having this moment where I'm thinking to myself, are we better off? I admit, again, I'm old. Old people have this question. Young people are just like, yeah, dude, phones. Though I will say, I mean, I don't know if you've had this conversation with students, but they do have this
right
odd, like, we know this is weird, but
yeah,
we don't know anything else. So what are you going to do about that, Mr. Professor Man?
Right. And I don't know. I think that we're still at a weird moment because we're still adjusting to this technology. You know, it hasn't fully become a part of our culture. And even people who grew up with it, even, like, ultra super millennials like we teach, it is still weird because they can't, you know, live their whole lives with this integrated mm-hmm. Technology. I think we will get to the point where it's, you know, more normalized, sort of, we've adjusted our culture to this, but I think that it's gone way too fast so far. I mean, I teach in class about technology shifts and stuff, and I always bring in these hysterical reactions to the telephone. And there's all of these, like, articles about how telephones will put churches and universities out of business. Because no one will ever leave their home or go into a public forum. They'll just call and have, like, information piped into their homes. And clearly that didn't happen, but...
Yeah, and you know, it's funny you should say that. That reminds me of two things. What the most pertinent one is, there was a guy at Westchester a few years ago who did his master's thesis about freakouts about writing technology.
Oh, interesting.
And because I don't know if you remember in the late 90s when we all got email and people were saying, email has ruined people's ability to write. And he made the much more sophisticated response was actually, no, it's probably making people who normally wouldn't write, write.
Right.
And suddenly is making them writers. I mean, people like my mom, who, you know, would maybe write one or two letters a year, but would then write me, I miss you a lot, A-L-O-T-T-E.
You know? Right.
and he traced, and he actually went back to the invention of the pencil.
Oh,
and did a rhetorical analysis of reactions to the pencil, which, of course, you can erase, which then devalues the word. And the word is no longer permanent, and that's legal and theological and social problems that all of a sudden the pencil, and he said it was the same rhetoric, it's the same freak out. It's just now it's AOL email. I still have my AOL accounts, speaking of dinosaurdom. So that's part of this. That's the Emily Post part about this. For our non-academic listeners, the structuralism part is the other big component of what makes this work and what it is. And if you could explain that to our good, fine, non-academic... that sounds totally snobbish, doesn't it?
This, for you non-academics, you bipeds out there, this we need to explain because we have been to graduate school.
How about our modernist or traditionalist listeners, you know?
Okay, there we go! Yeah,
not necessarily post-structuralist.
It's positive. But, I like it.
So, part of this, I'm, like, really obsessed with critical theory and post-structuralism and, you know, queer theory, critical race theory, all of these sort of big things in philosophy that came into literary theory from France in the 50s and 60s, and I have been since undergrad, and I just love it.
Me too.
And it's sort of these big philosophical sweeping things, and what I like about it is that it definitely has its own particular outrageous style of writing.
Yes.
That is at once, like, I do definitely connect with the ideas deeply, but I also think it's hilarious. Like, Michel Foucault, Derrida, Gayatri Spivak, Judith Butler, sort of these long, ridiculous sentences referencing a bajillion dead German philosophers and talking about the subject position in contemporary society. And it's just lovely.
Yes, there's that great Slavoj Žižek, who himself has his own weird stylistic language game that he plays. You know, he, in the documentary about him that Astra Taylor did, talks about how, you know, Judith Butler wouldn't, you know, he holds up a bottle of Snapple, actually. And he says, you know, Judith Butler would not say that this is a bottle of tea. She would say, if we were to buy into the suppositions of the contemporary language game, we could perhaps make the performative utterance that this is indeed a bottle of tea. You know, and he's exaggerating it a bit.
Right.
But for folks who suffer through, you know, really progressive undergraduate instructors, and certainly for folks who struggled and suffered through some graduate school, especially in literary studies or continental philosophy, you know, you sort of weirdly, the other part about it is too, is like some of that stuff is translated into English by people who understand, well, and you think about it, to do a good Michel Foucault translation. You got to understand English, French, and Michel Foucault.
Right.
And it seems like, same with Jacques Lacan in that old 1980 translation of Ecrits. That guy either understood two out of the three.
Right.
You know, he maybe got the French, maybe got the English, the Lacan, not so much, or maybe he understood Lacan in French, but
right.
What is this English you speak of sort right. of thing? And so, you know, how many people in this country spend their 20s
right.
and, just lost and the, in this world? But it's also really exciting.
And I think also, the other thing, especially for post-structuralist texts, you know, for post-structuralism, the word is decentered, we live in this prison house of language, and
yes.
the act of translation is an act of interpretive violence. So you get yes. these, like, completely off-the-wall translators who don't necessarily even feel bad about taking an interpretation yes. or doing something that sounds clunky, and you'll get these translators' prefaces where they're like, this doesn't sound like English, it shouldn't.
Yes, and, exactly.
Or, like, Gayatri Spivak, whose famous introduction to Of Grammatology is just about Gayatri Spivak translating Of Grammatology, and is just this, like, completely bonkers text.
Oh, yes, I just pulled out a book by Spivak that was translated by Spivak! Yes there we go. Imaginary Maps book. By Mashweta Devi, which is a great, mm-hmm. and I made her sound French, but she's Indian. Yeah, I think there's this, there absolutely is. I remember when I was studying for my comps, I had to read, I decided to read Derrida's Gift of Death, who is perhaps, yeah. he is maybe the most infamous
mm-hmm.
of
yes.
the writers of that movement. And to read Gift of Death, I had to read three pages and then go back and read the previous mm-hmm. two of the three pages that I just read. Read again and then maybe read three pages into the future and then go back. And I had to do this like recursive as I was going. I was like, I'm going to read three pages forward and two pages back. And it's like, you know, the book's like 90 some pages. And I think anything resembling like a thesis statement, like a, hey, this is what this book's about, is on page 63 of my edition of that book. But weirdly, you like, but the ideas themselves are so compelling and interesting mm-hmm. and disruptive
yeah.
that even though it's like, ah, it's for the true believers or whatever, it's the ideas themselves are so exciting.
Absolutely.
And disruptive and just like, yes, I remember having my master's level theory course and going, I am through the looking glass kind of thing. But rhetorically, the mm-hmm. language in terms of style is so ridiculous.
It's so ridiculous. And part of that, I think, is, you know, part of the rhetorical act that they're trying to perform. You know, by the time you get through a book by Michel Foucault, you've spent so much time with him that he is your only friend. Like, you've lost everyone else in your life, alienated them, and you've spent so much time trying to understand this one sentence in chapter 4 that you have to love it, because otherwise you've just spent 3 months of your life on this nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, I remember a grad school professor of mine talking about how he had a colleague at a different university, and the guy got on the elevator and knew everybody on the elevator, did not acknowledge anybody, got off before everybody else. And then everybody looked at each other, and somebody said, hey, listen, you know, that's so-and-so. He's always lost in someone else's mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is. And so you've created this thing. And so I think maybe the best way, I mean, there will be, of course, a link to the podcast, but I was wondering maybe we could do a couple. I could
yeah,
ask
absolutely.
The question and you do a little dramatic reading. So here we go, just to see how this works. Is it okay to include a list of gift ideas for my child's birthday in with the invitation?
By all means, subsume your guests in the morass of consumer capitalism. Even the act of celebrating your child's birthday has shown that you are unfit to be a parent. You have to understand that by publicly marking your offspring's partruition only further ingratiates it into the legal system. All cultures have social constructs that define the movement from childhood to adulthood, a moment designated by the Ur-Father, whereby the child must fulfill its social role. This effectively serves to erase the period of anarchic invention and leniency of childhood, and limit the possible options of the child within a classed and gendered society. While there is certainly an argument to support Joseph Campbell's claim that human beings are born some 14 years too soon, we can see that the rites of passage associated with age serve only to solidify social structure. Additionally, the birthday is associated with social function from an early age, dividing princesses from princes. The marketing of their of the U.S. American birthday only solidifies each child's status as a future soldier or housewife. It is telling that we must lure the young into their social roles with cakes and luxurious presents. If you're interested in having some sort of celebration, take all of the children you are planning to invite into the woods and leave them there to develop a new society outside the confines of civilization. They will thank you in a new, terrifying language.
You know, okay. Oh, boy. So, yeah, that's what it is. And if you've read this stuff, kind listener, you know what we're talking about. But, of course, that immediately brings me to a moment of crisis. I'm having a crisis right now, and that crisis is, I guess the other thing is if you become a scholar, you have to learn to write like that. And I'm having horrible flashbacks. I'm just pulling my dissertation off the shelf.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, if this was only a TV show, not a radio program. Here. I'll flip here. There it is. Doesn't that sound weighty and intelligent right there? I have some sentences like that, and I'm not joking.
Oh, absolutely. And same from when I was in undergrad and in graduate school. You do sort of fall into that. These are the writers, the theorists that you admire. And my friend and I, right before we graduated from undergrad, walked around and had this sort of sarcastic reminiscence of how many times we've, you know, totally destroyed capitalism and queered the nation state through 5-page, you know, seminar papers. And, like, what great work we'd done in undergraduate with these sweeping pronouncements and interpretive theory. And it's fun to do, but it definitely has an element of the ridiculous.
It does, which, I mean, there's a couple ways we can go here now. I mean, one is that the thought about, I think especially graduate school, as a kind of cult.
Absolutely.
You know, that kind of thing, like, and one of the things is it is to get a master's and a doctorate is you have to be a true believer. I mean, there is this mm-hmm. real question of, you know, do you worship the radish? in the inner sanctum of the Templar, you know, you mm-hmm. get there and there's just a radish on a pedestal or something and you go, yes, all-knowing, you know. I mean, you have to learn to use the lingo and prove that you could hang. I mean, that's part of it. I think also there is, just, again, the ridiculousness of it, but the weird loving it just the mm-hmm. same, you know, and thinking about how it's a joke, but in some ways I think these ideas have trickled into mainstream culture and have changed the world. I mean, like Jean Baudrillard, everybody who writes for The Daily Show has read Jean Baudrillard yes. in college. And that show, Jon Stewart, is not possible without this dead French sociologist.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah. we see, you know, Michel Foucault in The Panopticon sort mm. of popping up again and again in popular culture and yeah. freakouts about the NSA and
yes.
about all of the sort of, are we being observed everywhere? Is this, you know, national conversation? And I do think that there has been a huge trickle down into or trickle through or observation mm-hmm. about society that's in post-structuralism that I think holds up really strongly and speaks to something. Yeah, I don't know.
So let's do another question. Oh, yep. Okay, how to hurt your mom's feelings? Don't ask why.
Since you were a parasite in your mother's body, you have been failing her. You have broken her body, soul, and mind simply by your position, which transformed her into a mother. Motherhood is a wound that you inflict. All of your actions, even death, reopen that wound. Your existence and persistence in the world have already destroyed her. Simply continue to live.
Oh, that's so true. Actually, this is really uncomfortable. Julia Kristeva, yes, the Cora, yes. And you objectified your mother, but it's okay.
Right.
Because she sort of needs to objectify you, Simone de Beauvoir. Yes, I can see that. Mm-hmm. I can see what, which is, I guess, so if we think about critical theory, as I mentioned, is sort of the cult.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the sort of like blasphemous joke for academics? Is that what Emily poststructuralism is? It is the blasphemous.
I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily blasphemy, but I think what I'm trying to point out, or like interrogate at least, is sort of like you have these highfalutin big ideas that examine structures of society. And then I'm also totally obsessed with advice columns. I read like 10 a week. Totally love advice columns. I think they're so fascinating. This like popular form of asking someone for help. And like the purpose of critical theory, you know, it does have that amazing through the looking glass quality, but for the day to day sort of trials and tribulations, and like inviting people to your birthday party and like getting a dog, it doesn't always give you answers that are pleasant or operable.
Yes. You're right. Because that was the thing. You're right. I mean, you think about that's a trope. I mean, that goes back to, I mean, you could, you know, Nathaniel West, Miss Lonely Hearts, you know, this is, you know, the early days of maybe at least the 20th century, if not earlier, like sort of old-fashioned newspaper. It's still with us. I mean, there's some newer, there's the, was it Harlan Coben and Dan Savage and, you know, I mean, but yeah, you know, there's still kind of a Miss Manners kind of, you know, it's still out there.
Right.
And it's still with us. And it is both this maybe fascinating look into other people's lives. I mean, I remember, I will truly confess, as an adolescent male, you know, I would read the paper even then. And I was just sort of more interested in the paper a lot of times than I was in school. And there was the advice column in the sort of the local South Plainfield paper. And I remember there was one about a mother had written in about the size of her son's genitals. They had not, her son was like my age at the time, which was like early teen, and they still hadn't like developed. And I remember it was this like incredible voyeurism and, you know, locker room humor. And I cut it out and brought it, God, check this out, this is awesome, you know? And then my friend was like, I know, dude, did you see today? People wrote about that mom being too judgmental and she just got to chill out. And I was like, really? You know, and it's sort of, it's almost like a classier Springer.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
And I just like the idea of, you know, what if Michel Foucault was Dear Abby for a week? Like, what if he, instead of speaking to this, like, sort of rarefied group of people who, you know, make a living off of reading and interpreting his stuff, what if he was giving advice to the masses on, you know, wedding decorations or...
Yeah, you're right, because, I mean, you think about it, we do think about, you know, academic intellectual superstardom.
Mm-hmm.
But... Yeah, at some point in Michel Foucault's life, he had to buy drapes, probably.
Yeah.
You know, or walked out of the bathroom with a piece of toilet paper stuck to the heel of his shoe. Like, that happened to him once.
Oh, absolutely.
Without a doubt, or saying, well, you know, let's go, now let's not do a picnic for the birthday, or, you know, or, that's not a good wedding gift. You know, that kind of stuff, and would have these stupid problems that we all have that really aren't problems either, you know?
Right, and like don't necessarily refer to these grand, you know, superstructures of society, but could be put into them, you know? I'm sure during the barricades in 1968 student uprising in Paris, Michel Foucault farted at some point in some like small classroom in the University of Paris, and like, what did he feel about that? What did that say about the body? You know?
Yes. He wiped.
He wiped.
He would have to wipe.
Yeah.
We are the species that has to wipe.
Yeah.
Evolution's a joke on us, right? But yet we are, you know, made in his own image, and we have these highfalutin ideas about ourselves. And you're right, though, because that's that we're looping it back again. Because critical theory does have these, you know, nothing escapes,
right?
Nothing.
And these, like, I love their grand pronouncements. You know, everything is a sham. You know, you were all just trapped in this panopticon where everyone's just watching us all the time, and we're entirely bound up in the power structures of the world.
Ideology hails us into being.
Right, exactly. Yes. So I sort of love responding to these very basic questions about existence and inquiries with, like, these ridiculous pronouncements. Things, ways to live that are just impossible.
Yeah, so for example, can you make a living off of being a dog breeder? Like, could you live comfortably?
Comfort is a terrible thing. Well, on the one hand, it could be seen as the ultimate goal of human biology. Under capitalism, it has warped our biological drives into an unbelievably complex superstructure that only serves to fuel the mindless drive towards profit. Furthermore, we have swept up other species into our hurricane of society through domestication.
Oh, God.
The subjugation of lesser animals to our own will is disturbing. And positioning yourself as the quote-unquote breeder places you in a sexual relationship with these dogs. Indeed, you become the social conduit through which the dogs reproduce, and you then use the dogs as a social conduit in which to gain capital, both social and monetary. This dizzying movement of social positions is confusing. Both the dogs and the sexual act have become reified through this process. Financially, you may be comfortable, but I feel you will balk at the symbolic bestiality that you participate in. Instead, focus on making cross-stitches of Marx quotes for your Etsy store.
You had me till the end. Like, that was legit until the end. Oh, I mean, that's so close. You know? And I guess, I don't know if you've done that. You've gone to the conferences and the seminars where there is some also, too, hilariously bad writing.
Oh, yes.
That just people engage in or misread. Have you ever had that? You've gone to a conference and someone has completely misread something?
Oh, absolutely. And then I've had people questioned on that and then respond that it doesn't matter because that's how they read it, which is, like, totally post-structuralist. You know, the reader's interaction with the text creates the text, so therefore, you know, whatever. You know, whatever happens, happens.
Oh, good grief. Yeah. But yeah, so, I mean, it is ridiculous. But again, we love it.
Thank you so much. yeah, I really like writing it. It's a great way to exercise that muscle in my brain and, like, just have some fun and read weird questions.
Yeah, and so who's your audience then? Is it a niche audience, too? Like, do you get, like, weird kind of feedback from people? Or, like, because I always found, again, this is the cult aspect. Mm-hmm. There was a period in my life, and I got over it, and I got over myself, but, and I go over myself egotistically, that's what I mean, where I had a hard time for a while there not relating, being able to relate to my friends who had not read post-structuralism.
Yeah.
You know, I still, like, I know I see movies with friends, and I'm like, no, but you gotta understand how it works, right, man. No, this movie sucks, man, and this is why, because it's a trope, and it's ideological, and you're part of the Borg or something, you know, like, it's bad. It creates this weird social friction in my life that I still, like, have tried to work out and be better at and be more humane and human, but, like, so your audience.
That's, yeah. A lot of it is, a lot of folks from, like, grad school and undergrad who went into sociology and have some familiarity, but not, like, a lot with this kind of stuff, enjoy it. And, frankly, a lot of artists, because this sort of talk is how artist statements are written today.
Oh,
you know, you'll go
right
in and see a, you know, pile of blue crayons, and it's, you know, decentering the gender binary in an international context, according to the placard on the wall. And I'm on Tumblr, which is its own strange, weird world that even I'm too, like, way too grandpa for. and so a lot of my followers there are these, like, radical, queer, communist teenagers, which is awesome, and I have no idea who they are.
But say fantastic. Hi, right?
Hi, Tumblr followers. Thank you for, you know, following me. That's awesome. I like you guys.
Yeah. And I think it's important, though, for those kids, too, that, I mean, as we're saying, actually, now I'm thinking of it, there's, like, a teenager who, like, needs these ideas to live.
Yeah.
You know what absolutely. I mean? Especially, I mean, someone like Michel Foucault. I mean, if you are... You don't fit into the rigid traditional gender binary in America. Foucault can give people space to continue their lives. And that's important. So as we're making fun of this, this is important. And it's nice. That's great, though, that these kids are like, dude! You know?
Yeah, they're awesome. I mean, I don't know any of them, and they live all over the world. And I don't know how they found me. Which is really interesting. Tumblr is just this totally... weird space that I'm learning about, but I really like.
Yeah, which I guess that's the other thing, too, is it's like things do have lives of their own on the internet, too. The internet is, like, weirdly immediate, but forever. And then it comes around to get things, like, suddenly then come back. You know what I mean? It's, like, almost like sometimes, like, if the garbage man could, like, do drop-offs sometimes. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you remember this? Remember this can of tuna? Remember this? Like, 3 years ago? Yeah, well, you should have it again, you know? Kind of, that's the way the internet works, too. But you're right, Tumblr, it just seems like things just kind of loop and go and then...
Yeah, it's a totally strange and wonderful social space. So I'm very intrigued by it.
Yeah. I mean, have you ever gotten any sort of negative feedback or anything? Like, dude, this is, of course, this is gay or whatever, you know? Like,
no, I haven't gotten any yet. I mean, I don't have that many followers. I don't think that I have that big of an audience. Yeah. But
you should, though. You should.
Well, thank you.
I mean, again, I think everybody needs to know about these ideas. And then I think also everybody needs to then have a little discursive space where they can kind of have fun with the ideas. And so, okay, there's a ridiculous component, you know, of it. It's sort of like, you know, we're reading in one of my classes, Girlfriend in a Coma right now by Nicholas Copeland, and there's this idea of vision and prophecy in that novel. As I've been asking my students, like, well, if your friend told you they had a vision or a prophecy, what would you do? And they'd be like, tell them they're on drugs. And I was like, dude, isn't that the so much safer? Like, but what if you had absolute unambiguous truth? How would that totally screw up your life?
Yeah.
And they would be like, so you sort of need that space, like the neighborhood call in truth, you know?
Right.
I mean, I think, I'll confess this. I'm also maybe the only person I know who in college was really high on drugs and then had a religious vision. And then realize the next day, you know what? I was really high on drugs. I'm just going to go ahead and go say, you know what? I'm pretty sure it was the drugs. I'm pretty sure it was. It was. And no. A lot of other people, for whatever reason, make that other choice.
They just go straight to vision without
vision. Yeah. I mean, there was a guy at St. Francis who I'd heard about who... I think had just graduated when I was a freshman there, who he was on PCP, and the Virgin Mary told him that the only way, I mean, literally, he saw the fires of hell, and the only way out is pre-Vatican II Catholicism.
Oh my God.
That is the only way to salvation. Every other door is closed. And he was then in Intro to Philosophy with this great, you know, gone from my life, gone from everyone's life, and passed away, professor who changed everything for me, or helped change everything for me, his class, and was completely just disruptive and whacked out, and just like, you have to understand, you know, you have, I mean, the other part about that is, too, is, you know, if you know about Rainbow Roland Stewart,
he's
the guy who would, he would hold the John 3:16 signs at football games and baseball games in the 80s with the rainbow wig, rainbow afro wig. I write him in prison.
Oh, interesting.
Actually, I haven't written him since I moved. He's probably looking for my address. And again, I'll get these letters from him. It's like, 100 days. There's 100 days left. And I'll be like, damn. Whoa. And I mean, he, like, the the letters come like embossed metal. Like, he presses so hard on the paper that it curves upward.
Oh, my God.
And he will put exclamation point in the middle of words. Like, he'll get through.
Right.
And not even on the proper syllable break, either. Just like, you, blah, exclamation point. And it's, like, in the middle. It's like, oh, wow, you don't have any space.
Yeah.
And which, oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, and I think there's also sort of, I think that has something in this sort of prophecy, prophetic vision thing has something in common with theory and academics as well, in that you have this narrow field and every little thing becomes, you know, apocalyptic and like millenarian all of a sudden.
Yes.
You know, the amount of like shouting matches I've seen over, you know, a representation of, you know, about like Will and Grace or some like
yes.
ridiculous, especially working in cultural studies, which I do think that pop culture, and I love pop culture, I think it's very important and does some a great function. But at the same time, I think that a problematic representation on a sitcom might be symptomatic of something bigger.
Yeah.
But isn't necessarily completely apocalyptic in the way
yeah.
that it sometimes seems when you're totally involved in
yeah.
that world and so
yes.
single-mindedly and, looking forward.
Yes, and in the same breath, I mean, it does help channel our dreams. I mean, I remember
oh,
in my own dysfunctional family wishing I would wake up one morning in Growing Pains. Like, that I would be a Seaver.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? And so then you think about it, there is in that projection of myself, my pre-adolescent self, into that family, like, there were, like, I look back and say, wow, there were some things that I needed that I wasn't getting or whatever, you know. But, you know, the other big question is, I mean, do you find it odd when people dress up their cats?
Yeah, well,
see, I slipped that one in there.
You just slipped that right in. All right, let's see. I find the entire concept of quote-unquote dressing incredibly odd. Humanity has an obsession for concealing and revealing the body. An obsession that is continually inscribed in patterns of gender, race, and class. Indeed, we can see this as the state exercising a biopolitical imperative over private individuals. We always already wear clothes at the risk of alienating ourselves from our own bodies. The numerous accoutrements that we use to adorn ourselves are the links in the chain we have forged to bind ourselves to state power. By dressing cats in human clothes, people extend this false modesty and need to control the animal kingdom. Indeed, cat-bodied individuals are the perfect site for this project, as they are less servile than dogs. We so desperately want to humanize the natural world that we will dress a cat as Elvis, denying their subject position outside of human power structures.
You said subject position.
I suggest that you begin dressing in cats. Go about your day, totally nude, except for a few well-placed feline companions. And when they run away, you will be able to revel in your natural body. Instead of keeping yourself bound in clothing, you will let the natural world dictate when and how you are clothed. Good luck.
Now, I think that brings me to the last piece of this, though, is because since you are writing this down and you are thinking about the thoughts, I mean, it not only, it displays sort of a true understanding, like that you can know the discourse well enough. Oh, I just used the word discourse,
ooh,
like totally on
always good.
Discourse, again, for non-academic friends, that means language game parameters, way of speaking to fit a certain community. Or at least my definition of it is, because that's how I read it, damn it. of discourse, that you know the discourse well enough to mock it. But has this then actually given you like legitimate revelations and new understandings and possible like conference paper topics? Because, oh wait, actually, hold on. Wait a minute.
I've definitely, and there was a period about 2 weeks that I'm like maybe going to go back and edit, because I realized I was really stressed out, so I was sort of dashing them off fairly quickly. And I was realizing that I was just sincerely answering these. And, like, half believing all of my advice. And I'm like, oh, okay, I can totally, like, this is just what I think about, like, you know, lizards wearing hats or something. Like, from, you know, a Judith Butlerian perspective. It's, so I definitely have caught myself sort of maybe projecting a bit too much or buying into it, because it is very seductive language, and a lot of these are playing on ideas that I do sincerely believe. Yeah. Like, clothes, kind of silly. Maybe shouldn't be required everywhere. Am I going to walk around naked? No. Would I wear a cat? That sounds terrifying.
well, if it's declawed, less terrifying. But that's cruel, so don't do that.
Yeah, no declawing.
Yes. All right, I think now it is time for the bottom five.
Oh, excellent.
The bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topics. You can't do it in Emily Poststructuralism.
Oh, damn it.
These have to be sincere answers that are of a surrealistic, the questions are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature.
Ooh, excellent.
Are you ready?
I think I'm ready.
Question one. If reincarnation is real, and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease would you be?
Ooh.
I mean, if you, again, this is like you totally screwed up in life, karmically, and so you got to go back to single cell. But you get to choose. You can say, well, okay, you get what single cell you get to be.
I mean, that's sort of a hard one, but I'm pretty sure, I don't know. On the one hand, I'd want to be something relatively innocuous. Maybe, like, chlamydia. Something like, you know, you can knock it out. I wouldn't, like, ruin someone's life necessarily, but I'm kind of annoying, definitely present, and spread very easily.
Yes!
You know?
And spread in joy.
Right.
In moments of joy.
Exactly. And at least be able to participate in, like, some act of joy. You know, the common cold, I don't want to be, like, spread by sneezes. That's gross.
That's amazing. That is, that's I ask every guest their first time, and I hope there will be a second time for us. That question, that is one of the better answers. Chlamydia, yes. Mm-hmm. Two, this is from the book of Surrealist Games, actually.
Ooh,
so
excellent.
I've stolen this one, but I cited it, so it's kind of okay. And I'm not making any money off of this, so we're good. If you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or night?
Ooh. I'm going to have to go... Huh. This is really difficult. On the one hand, like, I don't know. No day would be really difficult. You know, vitamin D deficiencies, etc.
Yeah, well, we got vitamins.
But we got vitamins.
Yeah.
So I think I'd have to go with the total elimination of day. Because, you know... The shadows are very important, the things we can't see. I think that would be... And we'd all die quicker, which is probably the best-case scenario for the world.
Yeah, so. Yeah, this is true. This is true. Oh, you just gave me a flashback. Fifth grade, my teacher told us about taught us about nuclear war. We had a lesson on nuclear war and how, being a Jersey kid, we were still sort of a first-strike target.
Ooh.
And you definitely want to go first. Because radiation poisoning isn't cool. Way to go. And I just remember at fifth grade just going, okay.
All right.
You know.
Oh my God.
I've never recovered. anyway, okay. It's question three. This one maybe is a little more serious, a little more philosophical. Ooh. Are you ready? What limit to experience or personal limitation do most people impose upon themselves?
Ooh, limit to experience.
Or just sort of personal limitation that people impose upon themselves. Which is sort of a post-structuralism question, isn't it?
Yeah, that definitely is. I think most people... I'm going to go... Ooh, there's so many, like, tactics to take. Like, do I go Butlerian? Do I go Foucauldian?
Derridian?
Derridian. Go out on a limb and go Deleuzian.
Tasty.
I think that... I think that the most prevalent that I've seen is relational. Like, relationships that are possible. Sort of, like, boxing people into, like, you know, what a preconceived notion of a friend or an acquaintance or these sorts of... And I definitely do it myself as well, but, like, what a friend means and what you can say to that person, what you can do to them, and that, you know, there's this infinite spectrum of how you can relate to people. You know, you have this relationship with a person on a bus for 20 minutes, and that can be weird, and it can be great, and you can explore that.
And liberating, because you probably maybe never see that person again, especially if it's not your regular bus.
Right, but there's this sort of, you know, relationship category of stranger on a bus that you don't want to interrupt.
Yes.
But you can interrupt it, and it can be weird, and it can be great.
Yes. And you think, too, I mean, there's also, I think, long-term friendships with awkward silences, too.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, limitations. Like, this is my friend that I talk to about, you know, bad television shows. Yes. You, like, never quite break out of that.
Yes.
And I think that's just an interesting thing. Yeah, and I mean, a limitation.
That is a limitation. You wonder... I mean, some cases, are we missing out or are we better off?
Right.
Especially, I'm thinking with those long-term friendships sometimes.
Absolutely. And, I mean, I know that this is coming a lot from queer theory of, like, new families. Like, queer people building new families and what that looks like. And I think that's interesting to also apply to other facets. You know, what can new strangers be? What can new coworkers be? New long-term friends. I think that's interesting.
That is interesting. Yeah. Ooh, I like it. Quality. All right, question 4. What is your most irrational pet peeve? What is the stupid thing that sets you off that you know really shouldn't, but you could murder that person in front of their whole family?
Oh my gosh. I have so many.
Oh boy.
Most of my pet peeves are completely irrational. Oh my goodness. What?
Do we need to go top 5?
I don't know. No. I need to come up with something concrete. I think my... This is really difficult. Irrational pet peeve. I'm gonna have to say... Oh, what? Damn it. This is really difficult. Oh! Okay. My irrational pet peeve is people... So I am a public transportation person. I'm terrified of cars. One of my many neuroses. I don't have one. So I take the bus everywhere, and in the morning, on the bus, there's always people who get on the line early and just stand near the door.
Oh, they just those near people the door. Need to die.
And they just don't move back to the back of the bus. People continue to get on and have to press past them to get to the seats in the back, and there's even seats still left, and it just drives me absolutely bonkers.
Yes, I had a neighbor... who was an academic, actually, when I lived in Greenfield and would ride the old 56E, who would just, he would do that for no reason. And sometimes that bus was empty. And then he's like, I'm just going to be in everyone's way right now. You with the cane.
Right.
Good luck.
Right. You won't even be able to reach for the bars past me because I'll just be blocking them.
Yeah, oh man. And I'm a fat dude, so I'm like really aware of space and movement, I think, more than most people have to. But yeah, those people need to be shot into the sun.
Yep.
I mean, that's what you do with those folks.
Yep.
This is a little creepy. But anyway, and that's maybe why the day goes away. We shoot all the bus riders into the sun.
Exactly.
And the sun just kind of like burns itself out, you know?
Consumes all that fuel and explodes.
Yes, all that extra carbon. All right. Question 5. So you said you're afraid of cars, and so you don't have one.
Yes.
Is there anything in your home that you are afraid of?
Ooh.
Because I think this is important. I think everybody needs to have in their... home dwelling. If it's truly house becomes a home, I think part of that bargain is you have to have something in there that you're just like, damn, that's there. That's scary. It's there. I'll keep it there. I might need it someday. I have a table saw. That's mine.
Oh, that's pretty scary.
And that was when I bought that. And I, of course, bought the cheapest one because I'm like, I'm going to use this once a year. And I do use it once a year. But, oh my god, it's like fingers, I have them all. How is this possible? It's so loud and scary, and they kick back, and there's like guards that don't work on it, and the blade wobbles, and it's just terrifying. And I remember that when I bought it, I was like, wow, this
we're in a new epoch here. We're in a new era. Mm-hmm. Well, I understand now. Yes, I have something I am scared of, and it's here. So do you have anything that you're just like, you know, and I know you live with someone, and your partner's just like, yeah, that's his.
Oh, yeah. I don't live with my partner, but I have two roommates. Yeah.
Oh, you do have two roommates.
Yeah.
Oh.
But what I'm similar, in a similar assuming, vein, yeah. I actually have a brand new Cutco bread knife.
Oh.
11-inch serrated bread knife.
Wow. That's hardcore.
Gigantic and brand new, and I bake bread, and like all of our other knives, my two roommates and I have the worst knives, so they would just don't cut anything. So I always use this for the bread, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to cut my finger off and like bleed all over everything and die. And they'll find my body tomorrow, and it'll be a whole thing. It'll be messy.
Yeah, serrated knives are hardcore. I'm now thinking of the remake of All Quiet on the Western Front with Ernest Borgnine and the guy who played John Boy Walton. And he's like, serrated? Who told you to do that? It's an agreement both sides. They find you with this, they'll pull your eyes out and fill your sockets full of sawdust. You know, yeah, so that was actually I have a nice chalk. My mom bought me a chalk of like really nice knives. Oh. And it was my introduction to Paula Deen. Like, I had no idea who Paula Deen was. And I have this set of Paula Deen knives. And there's just this picture of her on the box with that like sort of unnatural smiling, but it hurts, or until it hurts, like overly white teeth. You know, this person of, she was always this person you think, wow, that is someone not comfortable in their own skin. And so this like just grimacing face staring back at me. And then I would pull them out of the chalk and it would make the shing sound. Ooh. So I totally get what you're... I've tamed that beast, though, at least.
That's good.
Yes, that is good.
Yeah.
All right. So we will, on the Gonna Die podcast website, we'll put the link to Emily Post Structuralism, both your FaceTube and your FaceTube about your Tumblr.
Excellent. You know, we'll have any links. Much.
Thank you. This is great. But I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and all old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast. And we're all going to die on Facebook and Google+. You can be the other person who follows me on Google+. Not that I update that page, but I will one of these days. Keep chasing the rainbow, kids. Thanks to Brett Zorick, as always, for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.